I'm going to turn it back over to the mothership.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in on Election Day, November 3rd at 6 p.m. to hear KBOO's Election Night Special. We will start the evening with a live stream of Democracy Now! At 7:30, we will be tracking national, state, and local results live, as well as hearing from community groups and your favorite KBOO programmers as we break down this historic election. Again, that's KBOO's Election Night Special starting at 6 p.m. on November 3rd at 90.7 on your FM dial or online at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky.
Walter Tevis, who died in 1984 at the age of 56, only wrote six novels. The first was The Hustler, which was adapted into a classic film with Paul Newman and Jackie Gleason. And the second, The Man Who Fell to Earth, was adapted into another classic movie starring David Bowie. Later came two science fiction novels, Mockingbird in 1980 and Steps of the Sun in 1983. Also in 1983 was The Queen's Gambit, which is now a Netflix miniseries, and his final novel, The Color of Money, a sequel to The Hustler with a different plot than the Scorsese film, came out the year of his death, 1984. This interview was recorded in the stairwell of Cody's Bookstore in Berkeley in October 1981 on the publication of Tevis's only short story collection, Far From Home. My co-hosts were Richard A. Lupoff and Lawrence Davidson.
Norman Spinrad pulled The Man Who Fell to Earth, a single-entry novel, into the science fiction genre by a so-called mainstream novelist. He also referred to you as an essay.
I was pissed, and I thought he was wrong. Maybe he didn't know about those stories. Some of them had dwelled in obscurity for several years, and the thing I was mainly known for at the time I did The Man Who Fell to Earth was The Hustler, which everybody thinks, anyway, is pretty far from science fiction. I've worked both sides of the street for some time, still am. That was a long time ago, and right now in my life, I'm not sure whether I'm a science fiction writer or not. Mm-hmm. But I think I've written enough science fiction that, willy-nilly, I am.
About those early science fiction stories of yours, from 1957 onward, those are collected in Far From Home.
Right.
Would you talk a bit about the editors you worked with on those stories, how those stories came to be written, and how the relationship worked between yourself and your publishers?
Had no relationship with my publishers whatever. I was teaching in small towns, teaching high school English in small towns in Kentucky at the time, and I merely wrote them and I sent them off and I prayed for a check. There was no editorial impedance or assistance that I can recall. I do remember that one or two of them were bought by Robert Mills, who later became my agent as a result of an elaborate series of events. But it was just a case of writing them, sending them off. It was sort of like entering coupons in a raffle or something and waiting to see what happened. I would like to say about those stories, they were a kind of thing that really charmed me at the time. I don't know if I could do them now or would want to do them now, but at the time I was very much caught up in the extrapolation of a sort of a simple what-if idea in a science fiction story.
Yes.
Or what, and especially devices that turned upon, you know, some kind of an unusual substance, an unusual invention or something like that. I really liked that. I think in a deeper way, it was a way of staying away from my feelings, of being able to write off the top of my head. I was a very good chess player in those days, too, and I think the same kind of mentality was involved. You know, this is something I can do without really getting my guts involved.
Yes. Which was the bouncing ball story?
The Big Bounce, it's called. You know, that was a lot of fun. That idea really got to me, and I still like it, the idea of making a simple conversion of thermal energy into electrical energy or kinetic energy of some kind or another. You know, the idea for that story, I recall very much, came from my buying my first air conditioner and realizing I was going to have to plug money into the system and put electricity into the system in order to put energy into the system in order to remove energy from my room. And it seemed horrendous, and I wanted to find some way around it, you know, or if there's some way you could, you know, sell that energy or get rid of it. And I invented a rubbery compound that would cool off and deliver additional velocity each time it bounced. Isaac Asimov later told me it was impossible, that I was violating the second law of thermodynamics, but I was in another state where that law didn't apply.
You mentioned Isaac Asimov, which brings up something that Dick and I were discussing before. What contact, physical contact, did you have during the 50s and early 60s with other science fiction writers?
I spent about an hour and a quarter with Harlan Ellison once. and that was it. I was a high school English teacher in Kentucky at the time, very much outside of the circuit of science fiction writers. And I've actually met very few of them, and it just happens to do with the places I've been living. For 13 years after I taught high school, I became a college professor in Athens, Ohio, and there just aren't many science fiction writers around. There's one, Dan Keyes, who was a good friend of mine, who wrote Flowers for Algernon, and he and I played chess and poker and shot pool and saw each other all the time.
Did you ever think of writing a story together?
Nope. We're very competitive with one another. We're good friends, but it wouldn't work. I wrote a story together with Ted Cogswell, Theodore R. Cogswell, years and years ago. It was published in a British science fiction magazine as written by Tevis Cogswell. Can't even remember the title of it, but we got $15 for it.
The other night, the Hustler was on the tube.
Yeah.
And I was watching and wondering about some of the references, knowing that you had come from Oakland and the kid had Eddie.
I came from San Francisco. It's a disguised autobiographical reference. The past Eddie comes from Oakland, right?
I was wondering whether or not, you know, how fluent you were as a pool player.
I was sort of a B-minus pool player. I suspect that I could beat anybody in this room, but I could not play against professionals with any hope of winning. Much of the pool room scene, as it appears in The Hustler, was made up by me and was not the way that pool rooms really looked. I didn't know that much about pool rooms, although I did know something about them. But pool rooms have come to resemble The Hustler since. In fact, I've heard that at least two pool hustlers have had their thumbs broken since The Hustler was written, and, you know, that never happened. And then there's a fat guy who goes around calling himself Minnesota Fats, which is astonishing to me.
Oh, your Minnesota Fats came first.
Yes, indeed.
I thought it was based on
I know, everybody, a lot of people. Yeah, people ask me, when did you first meet Minnesota Fats? And I feel like Walt Disney being asked, when did you meet Donald Duck? I said, come on, I made him up. One of my contributions to American folklore. You talked about the West Coast reference, by the way. I was thinking as I drove up here, I was trying to think of witty things to say. I was thinking of a very true thing, that there were a question of where did the man who fell to earth fall from? He fell from San Francisco. And I can go into that, but essentially that book is a very disguised autobiography. It is based upon my own feelings from time to time that I'm from another planet, feelings which I've not altogether negated within myself, which I tried to negate within myself with booze over a large number of years. But it has to do with my having moved from what I felt was the City of Light, San Francisco, when I was 11. To the other side of the tracks in Lexington, Kentucky, where I went to a tough Appalachian school in the sixth grade and was beaten up regularly. And when I went there, I went after having been a year and a half in the Stanford Convalescent Hospital for Children. I was skinny, weak. I'd had to spend a full year in bed. They didn't even let me out of bed to go to the toilet. And I wasn't aware of this consciously when I was writing The Man Who Fell to Earth, but I certainly, it, you know, just knocked me over when I read the book afterwards in galleys. You know, that was, of course, what I was doing. It was as though I had been living in a low-gravity planet. And as you know, that although in the movie, The Man Who Fell to Earth winds up in New Mexico, that's because Nick Rode, the director, likes deserts. But in the novel, he winds up in Kentucky. And it was me coming from San Francisco to Kentucky. Okay, there's a very elaborate answer to a question about Fast Eddie and Oakland.
How did you feel about the movie, The Man Who Fell to Earth?
I give it a C+.
What do you think about Bowie?
Oh, I think he was terrific. That was genius casting. I think that was really wonderful. And he's a wonderful man. I had that book, I sold 5 movie options to. It came out in 1963, and the movie wasn't made until, I think, 76 or something like that, 75. And I had 5 different producers option it. In fact, I made more money out of movie options than I did on book sales. And I would talk with these various producers about who would play the part, and seriously consider were such people as Peter O'Toole and Oscar Werner and James Coburn. In fact, James Coburn wrote me. He wanted to buy an option on the book for a piffling sum. But when it was already optioned to somebody else and I couldn't sell it to him. I can imagine James Coburn is, well, it wouldn't be too bad, the white hair, the tall, skinny figure, no. But it would never, and I knew who David Bowie was. My kids played his records all the time over my protests, you know, and that kind of thing.
Were you
but
startled?
It never would have occurred to me. I was startled. I really was startled. But it seemed right. It really did seem right. And when I met him, it seemed even more right.
What'd you feel about Rogue as a director?
He's got a very good eye. He's got a good visual sense. We fought a lot, and you know, it is, and there's no question. I don't think, when a novelist sells his book to the movies, I think he has to defer to a large extent to the director. It's a director's medium, and you can't have everybody saying how to make the movie. But with due recognition of that fact, I think that he feels that it isn't art if you can understand it. And I hate that notion. I really hate it. And I think when you do a parable, which is more or less what I do in science fiction, you have to be upfront about what's going on in the foreground. You know, to put myself in a very high category, for the sake of illustration, I think, say, that Jesus Christ and Franz Kafka are very good tellers of parables. And you never wonder in a Jesus Christ story, you know, how many sheep and shepherds are being talked about, and, you know, and who lost what sheep, and who planted the mustard seed, and all that kind of thing. You may not know how to take it. In fact, people have fought and died on battlefields throughout the Middle Ages over how to take these parables, but you know what's going on in the foreground. And people will say about Franz Kafka stories, you know, I don't understand it. Well, they do understand it. You know what's going on, you just don't know how to take it. It's very difficult. And I want people to know what's going on in The Man Who Fell to Earth. And in Nick Rogue's presentation of the movie, you don't. There are a lot of things you just don't know about. And to hell with that. I want that all to be clear.
How do you feel about reading the book and then seeing the movie?
You know, in my case, since I wrote the book, I have my own very strong images of what the characters look like and what their voices are like and so forth. There's a certain wincing that you get when you hear your dialogue spoken. You know, you say, that isn't the way it sounds. That isn't the way he looks. So, on the other hand, there were a couple of scenes in the Man Who Fell to Earth movie over which I really cried. I was whacked. I mean, it was crying for myself. It is Marguerite you mourn for. You know, I was, because I could really get, you know, something that I hadn't been able to see in the book itself. The movie, it's like seeing your own dream, you know, suddenly thrown at you in an incredible deja vu circumstance. You don't see it so clearly when you're reading the book because you're used to the language and you know, you're protected from what your book means. But when you see a version that goes through somebody else's set of filters, it can be overwhelming.
Recall specifically what those moments were.
Yeah, there were some of them that had to do with my alcoholism. Now, The Man Who Fell to Earth is about my becoming an alcoholic, really. That's my private story, and about my sense of my own physical weakness and my sense of my not really being human. The quality, I, you know, Spofforth and Mockingbird is the same thing to some extent. Mockingbird's about coming out of alcoholism. At least that's, for me it is. I don't necessarily demand that people understand it that way, but that's what it means to me. A scene where he vomits into a wastebasket in the hotel room, as I have done. And to waste baskets in a hotel room, you know, being your garden variety alcoholic, I've had all those experiences and had had some of them before I wrote that book, although I was, you know, I was sort of on the threshold of alcoholism when I wrote it. I'd sobered up from an 8-month drunk to write it. And then just the sense of his awkward movement and the pain of moving around, which I had felt as a child so much after that convalescence, and his feeling generally of goodwill toward people but being afraid of them. I'd like to go on about that business of movies, and because something else came to my mind when you asked about it. I had to reread The Man Who Fell to Earth and The Hustler not so long ago, And when I read The Man Who Fell to Earth, I did not see David Bowie in my imagination as my character. I saw Thomas Jerome Newton, who is not me, really. You know, I see him as a very white-haired, very thin person with a dark complexion, quite tall, very narrow on the shoulders. And the description doesn't quite really fit me. But when I read The Hustler, which I know is older, but when I read The Hustler, I cannot see my characters. I can't see Fast Eddie, and I can't see Minnesota Fats. I see Paul Newman and Jackie Gleason. And you know, and it's infuriating. You know, damn it, you've raped my imagination. And that was the case. You know, and that's not the timeline, because that was the case 15 years ago that I had lost the memory, as it were, of what those characters looked like. Maybe that's a testimony to the fact that The Hustler is a better movie, at least in my view, than The Man Who Fell to Earth, or I don't know. But anyway, it certainly is testimony to the fact that the movies can rape the imagination. And when the author can't remember what his own characters look like, it's certainly something.
You're listening to an October 1981 interview with author Walter Tevis. My co-hosts for the interview were Richard A. Lupoff and Lawrence Davidson, and I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
In both of your science fiction novels, you make references to Bruegel's Fall of Icarus. Why are you so fascinated with it?
You know, it's oddly enough, it's Auden's poem about the painting that I love so much. I'm just crazy about that poem. I like Auden.
I'd like to ask a little about your own background in science fiction. I know in a press release that we got, you mentioned Fritz Leiber and Theodore Sturgeon. Did you read, when you were growing up, did you read the pulps at all?
Sure, I did indeed. Every one that I could steal, I stole many of them. Amazing Stories, Fantastic Adventures, both Ziff Davis, Astounding Science Fiction, which was Street and Smith in those days, and Super Science, Thrilling Wonder Tales, the whole bit, in the late 30s and early 40s. Everything I could get my hands on.
Any favorite writers from that period?
Stanley G. Weinbaum, Nelson S. Bond. I could start naming stories like The Fertility of Dalrymple Todd or Sojar of Titan. Anyway, sure, I was up to my armpits in science fiction for years and years. And then I quit reading it when I was something like, 18. I would pick up an occasional book, you know, that I'd heard about. But I've not really been totally immersed in it since then, although since I've just finished yet another science fiction novel, I've got now four science fiction books in a row. It's about damn time I, you know, got back into it and found out whether I'm, you know, whether I'm 20 years behind what's going on.
You're not. I hope it was intentional on your part, but the opening scene was the most bizarre and totally successful piece of black humor that I had read in years, about a robot trying to commit suicide and can't do it.
Gee, I didn't think of it that way. I'm pleased with the effect that it had on you. I was writing out of my own suicide attempt, out of a couple of them, and trying to make a parallel with Spofforth and King Kong. King Kong moved me greatly when I was about 5 or 6 years old. I really responded to the ape and to his feelingfulness, you know. And I didn't catch on to it then, but I did catch on later, I think when I first read Frankenstein, maybe, to that factor that in the non-human character in works like that, you get a tremendous emotional charge, especially when they are surrounded by such stick figures as they usually are. The people aren't worth a shit in King Kong, or in Frankenstein, or in 2001, as opposed to Hal the Computer, or the Frankenstein Monster, or King Kong, whom I loved, you know. And I mean, the writer can allow himself to pour out a lot of feelingfulness on those non-human characters, which, of course, is what I do with Newton and The Man Who Fell to Earth, and Spofforth and Mockingbird. But actually, you know, that scene has a literary source in a sense. It's kind of borrowed from The Scarlet Letter, which opens on the scaffold in the center of town with Hester and her public appearance before everybody. Nobody's there to look at Spofforth, finally. And then closes with her on the scaffold in the center of town. A lot of The Man Who Fell to Earth, I was embarrassed to discover, was kind of borrowed from a movie called The Day the Earth Stood Still, in which skinny Michael Rennie plays a benign visiting spaceman. And, you know, I know, they're not at all alike, really. He's handing out diamonds to Patricia Neal and all, and saying, Katu Barada Nikto, and all that stuff. But, you know, when I saw the movie a few years after writing The Man Who Fell to Earth, it was really kind of embarrassing, because I realized I made some unconscious borrowings from it.
I want to ask you two questions about other books. First of all, you just mentioned that you have another science fiction novel coming. How much do you want to say about that now, or is that, you know, a sealed matter?
Well, can we stay here until next Thursday?
Well, I will have.
Yeah. It's tentatively titled Belsen. I will probably change the title because I don't want to invoke the concentration camp of the same name. It takes place in New York and in outer space in the 21st century. It's the most autobiographical novel I've written. It's a first-person quasi-comic book novel. Its main character, Benjamin Belson, is a New York real estate tycoon who, at the age of 50, discovers that his sex life has gone bluey, he's gotten impotent, thing which happened to me briefly, thank God. Everything in his life is messed up. He's tired of making money, he's tired of this, he's tired of that. He buys a Chinese spaceship. There have been space explorations for uranium in the earlier part of the 21st century, but they hadn't worked, and he buys a mothballed Chinese spaceship called the Flower of Heavenly Repose. The Chinese have gone back to the old nomenclature. Through a woman named Pear Blossom Lou, he buys this spaceship and heads out into space hunting for safe uranium to use. Since the Denver incident and things of that sort, uranium plants have been difficult, but there's an isotope of uranium only found on other planets, you fellas understand. The book opens with him in chemical sleep on board his spaceship, working out on zero-gravity Nautilus machines, getting rid of his pot and building up his muscle. You know, in zero gravity, you can't use weights, you have to use springs. But he's got a trainer with him on board his spaceship. The spaceship is furnished with antiques, and and it has a gym, and the trainer puts him into the Nautilus machines while he's asleep, and he works out. But while he's sleeping, he regresses in memory to his childhood. It's really me doing psychotherapy to some extent, you know, disguised as science fiction, just like me sobering up is what Mockingbird is about, you know, and the like. And I'm crazy about the book. I really love it. I've got to rewrite the last 125, 150 pages, which I wrote too quickly, but it's all done, and I really like it a lot. Doubleday's going to publish it.
The other one I wanted to ask you about is a book that doesn't exist but ought to, and that is you have a fair number of uncollected short stories. You mentioned earlier this little one that you did with Coswell, but you also have some non-science fiction short stories.
Oh, yeah.
How much uncollected Tevis fiction is there, and what chances do we have of ever seeing it in covers?
Oh, gosh, there are about, I guess, 25 stories or so, a lot of them about pool players, which I wouldn't want to publish, partly because I borrowed from them for The Hustler, and they do resemble one another too much. And then there are a bunch of pieces of magazine fiction dating from the 50s that I like a lot, I'm very fond of. I don't know, every now and then somebody suggests to me collecting them and putting them out. Maybe I will someday.
Well, whose idea was Far From Home?
Mine.
You select all the stories for it.
Yep. I wrote a couple especially for it, A Visit from Mother and Daddy, the two stories that I liked the best in there. And I did try to peddle them to magazines, but it was no dice. They're kind of heavy-duty stories, strong, sexually strong, that kind of thing.
Rent Control is one of the most bizarre, wacko stories that I've read in the past 30 years. There must be a background to that.
The lady in the corner will tell you all about it there. It's based on living with a lady in New York City for about a year. Really, it didn't happen the way it happens there, but based on my recognition that I was involving myself too closely and too narcissistically in a love affair. A lot of what opened up for me in writing these stories, and what's very meaningful to me now, and was useful to me in doing Belson, which I was just talking about, is my realization that I can use this psychological material in a science fiction context, and it works extremely well for me. I feel very comfortable doing it that way, whereas if I were to write confessionally, autobiographically, it'd be a miss.
Do you feel yourself doing more and more in the way of short fiction as time goes on?
I am delighted to say the contrary. There was a long time when I felt that my attention span was too damn short to write novels. And I do write short novels, as you probably noticed. But I find myself really thinking more and more in terms of the longer length. Although I must make an aside for one thing. One thing I discovered in writing a screenplay is it's a terrific length. A movie is about 120 pages long. And that really is fine. There's a part of me that like to be a lyric poet. That's the real short attention span writer. You know, one burst, you know, 16 lines, and there it is.
If you're willing, I'd like you to talk a little bit about writing techniques and attitudes, such as how fast do you write, how long does it take you to do a short story or a novel, and so on.
Yeah. Okay, I generally do a short story in a city, or sometimes in 2 days. I pay a price for this. I don't necessarily recommend it, but I happen still to be suffering from a pretty serious block. I have a terrible time getting myself to work, and I don't have any excuses to make. I don't have, you know, I write entirely for a living. My children are raised and have left home. I never outline. My best ideas come at the typewriter. I write very fast. I triple space so that I'll have plenty of room for repenting at leisure over what I've done. And at least at present in my life, I have to catch myself when I'm hot. And then I work practically until I drop. And then I spend a lot of time sitting around staring at the ceiling and scratching my ear and you know, wondering why I'm in this damn profession of writing and all that sort of thing. It's not the best way to work, but it's the only way that I presently know how. I would like to get spiritually grown enough to the point that I could work about 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, you know, and go to church on Sunday or whatever to clean up my language. But I don't do any outlining. I don't do any researching. I was tempted in writing Mockingbird to start watching Sonnet movies, you know, and see if I could pick up some interesting stuff to use. And I realized that would have been just a dodge to avoid the typewriter. I never research anything.
You paint a pretty bleak picture in terms of literacy in Mockingbird.
Yeah. It comes from 25 years of being an English teacher.
Do you see just a decline in literacy?
My private experience as an English teacher has been that Americans don't read books. They didn't read books in 1949 when I started teaching. They don't read books now in 1981. Television did make a difference, deepened the slack of the slack jaws and gave another great quantity of garbage for people to fill their lives with, but you know, there was other garbage around before television. A Mockingbird does sometimes, I think, weaken into an attack solely on television and on the modern world. And weaken, I say, because I'm not completely convinced of all of those things that I say, but what I am convinced of is that it is very bad for people to find substitutes for living their lives, and that's what I hope I do say, and say well from time to time in the book.
It seems to me that in a number of your works, and mostly, or most emphatically in Mockingbird, you're portraying a peculiar kind of tyranny where there is no mailed fist, there is no club or whip, but we're just cozened and cajoled into acquiescence, yeah, to our own dominance.
Yeah, and nobody much is doing it. The government of the United States, when it appears, is just a silly voice coming from a computer somewhere. You can do what you damn well please, really, in the world of Mockingbird, but nobody knows that. Or you can almost do what you please. I mean, Paul gets locked up for what he does, but then it's an easy jail to get out of.
In a sense, it's also the same thing with the man who fell to Earth. I mean, he could do whatever he wants to.
Sure.
He finds himself trapped.
Yeah.
In here.
Right.
His head.
Right. Right.
Which I would gather relates to your own.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. I'm sure. I have to get an incarceration episode in every one of my books. Even Fast Eddie in The Hustler, although he's not locked up, he has his thumbs broken, and is forced to depend upon Sarah, his girl, who maybe at death is really my mother, who presided over me in a kind of ghoulish way during my illness when I was a kid, and becomes dependent on her. And none of those things were conscious in the writing of them, but they kind of sat me reading about it afterwards. You know, you do find as a writer that you're writing the same story over and over again, whether you want to or not. It's kind of scary.
What was this illness? You mentioned having been in bed for a year.
Yeah, rheumatic heart, rheumatic fever, and St. Vitus dance, all three of them. So I was diagnosed. I didn't feel sick, and I had St. Vitus dance, but I didn't dance.
What do you see as your future? I mean, do you plan to write, to stay writing science fiction?
I want to work both sides of the street. When I finish Belson, I intend to write a realistic novel somewhat along the line of The Hustler, perhaps. I mean, it won't be about a gambler, but a book in that general vein of verisimilitude realism. You get tired of making up the world of science fiction. After a while, it gets shrill. It gets to be an automatic reflex to start making up thought buses or whatever. It's fun for a while, but it gets routine.
It seems to me, in your novels in particular, that there is a peculiar blend, a gentle tragedy, rather than really horrendous tragedy, with always a hopeful note at the end, as, for instance, in The Man Who Fell to Earth. For all the downfall that has happened to Newton, at the end, he is surviving. He is somehow sticking it out and moving along. Right. At least he's there today and he'll be there tomorrow, and maybe he's going to get it together and be all right. In Mockingbird, much more positively, we have a rebirth of hope at the end. And in The Hustler, Fast Eddie at the end somehow overcomes, or seems to be overcoming, his own weakness and failures, and is going to go on to something better.
Yeah. I think you've described it very well. I don't know how to account for it. I hardly have a comment to make. I'm really impressed with the way you stated. It's not an effect that I aim at. I suppose it derived to some extent from my own unfinished sense of my own life and my own lack of knowledge as to whether it's comic or tragic. But I don't design my books to have a particular outcome, but they do wind up in a kind of uncertain way. Mockingbird ends up deliberately hopeful. I wanted it to be hopeful. I feel hopeful. I feel a lot more hopeful about life than I used to. I feel a hell of a lot better about living. I like the fact that the grass is green. I really am pleased with that in a way that I didn't used to be.
You've been listening to an interview with author Walter Tevis, recorded in October 1981 in the stairwell of Cody's Bookstore in Berkeley. Belson was renamed Steps of the Sun and was published in 1983, which was the same year as his novel The Queen's Gambit, which is now a Netflix miniseries. All books by Walter Tevis are now available as e-books. My co-interviewers were Richard A. Lupoff and Lawrence Davidson, and I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
Está sintonizando la radio de KBOO Portland.
We are trying to find small education reform within our own community as immediate as possible, and we are making those steps, listening. There's people out here who are willing to go to these forums and listen to what people have to say, advocate. We are providing an online platform and physical platform for people to discuss and work at ways of dismantling racism and allyship. We are forming bonds with people and can make a connection so that we can eradicate racism and allyship, creating these bonds with people that can make a huge difference.
Welcome to Sprouts from Pacifica, radio from the grassroots. Sprouts is a weekly program that showcases radio productions by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week. Today on Sprouts, Youth Resisting Racism. Two independent media programs, Outcasting and The Children's Hour, joined forces to share their response to the apparently unjustified police killings of George Floyd and other people of color, the culture of racism that we live in, and ideas on how we can truly work toward a society that champions liberty and justice for all. Hi, I'm Justin from Outcasting Media, creator of Public Radio's LGBTQ youth programs. I'll begin today's program with some thoughts, a poem, and an interview with Jalay Knowles, founder of What About Us, a local activist organization in New York. As a Black gay teenager in America today, I recognize that in the eyes of many, I am not fully equal. Despite many gains, LGBTQ people are still subject to discrimination in many ways. And of course, discrimination against Black people exists in many terrible and violent ways as well. Equality is supposed to be one of the guiding principles of the United States. Yet, I'm not equal. And I recognize that whatever equality I do have was fought for. It didn't just exist as it does for white straight people. The rights we have today were gained through protest, rallies, and riots. But we continue not to have the full rights that white straight people have. This is why both of my communities, LGBTQ and Black, must keep fighting for greater equality. I've had to understand since I was a child that simple things like going for a run, holding someone's hand, or getting pulled over by the cops could get me killed. I've always had to watch what I do around people because of the simple facts of whom I love and what my skin color is. During Black History Month this year, I presented a poem about the oppression and killing of innocent Black people. As a result of the protest and riots in the name of the Black Lives Matter movement, I realized, at this time in particular, my voice needs to be heard. Here's the poem. Walking through the city streets, past sundown, keeping my hands out of my pockets, hood down, pick in hand, police sirens wailing, screaming out of the megaphone, "Get on the ground." My knees hitting the concrete. "Drop your weapon," they say. Children screaming, lights gleaming, women crying, shots firing, heartbeat dropping, laughter stopping. It was a misunderstanding, they say, but we all know their ways. Headlines: Black teen resist police. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Eric Garner are just a few of the thousands of Black people who have been killed unjustly by police officers. George Floyd allegedly used a counterfeit bill and was killed after a Minneapolis police officer detained him by kneeling on his neck for over 8.5 minutes on May 25th, 2020. Breonna Taylor was shot and killed in her sleep by police officers in her Kentucky apartment during a police raid on the wrong apartment. It has never been and will never be true that Black lives matter more than others. It's simply that, as a community, we've seen how little Black lives matter to some people in power. I am tired of not getting listened to. We are all tired of not getting listened to. Our voices are important and need to be heard. The community I live in has been relatively peaceful, but that doesn't mean that there isn't racism. Earlier this year, 4 letters of the N-word and a swastika were carved into a bathroom stall. The next day, the Student Equity Club, of which I'm a member, gathered to talk about the incident. The principal was very honest with us. He explained to us how shocked he was and said that whoever committed this act of hate would be dealt with accordingly. Throughout the day, the principal held an assembly for each grade, keeping in mind the priorities of our equity group, which are to achieve and maintain equity through education and ensure a similar response to any future acts of hate in our school. With this act of hate in students' and educators' minds, we were all more open to having these uncomfortable conversations about racism, sexism, homophobia, and so many other real-life topics. And with the Black Lives Matter movement becoming more prominent than ever before, it was important to know that I could have these uncomfortable yet important conversations in a school setting. I sent an email about the Black Lives Matter movement with my poem to the student body and most of the faculty at my school. The email prompted conversations with several people, some of whom I didn't even know. One teacher said she's been struggling with these issues and spends time every day talking about them with her children. Another, who has a Black transgender son, said she lives in fear and wants the world to find meaningful answers and justice for everyone. Among the responses, a common thread was fear for the safety of Black family members. It was amazing to receive so many supportive responses to my email, and the conversation needs to continue. With that in mind, a woman named Jalay Knowles started a local activist organization in Austin, New York, called What About Us. I spoke with her about the organization and what she hopes it can accomplish. Jalay, thanks for joining us. Tell us how you started.
My activism started with watching the video of George Floyd being murdered, and kind of, I think everyone can agree that enough was enough and it should have been enough. But I think in the moment now, I work at Roosevelt Elementary School in Ossining, and I thought of the kids that I work with. So at that moment, I realized that I needed to do something for them and just be a part of the movement. And that's what I wanted to do.
With your organization, What About Us? What are your main goals? What do you want to reach? What are your short-term and long-term goals?
Our 4 main key components are to educate, to listen, to advocate, and create allyship. All 4 can start off with short-term goals. For example, education. We are trying to find small education reform within our own community as immediate as possible, and we are making those steps, listening. There's people out here who are willing to go to these forums and listen to what people have to say. advocate. We are providing an online platform and physical platform for people to discuss and work at ways of dismantling racism and allyship. We are forming bonds with people and making connections. And those are all short-term. Long-term is complete education reform at a higher level to really listen in and hone in on everybody's perspectives, to really be an advocate so that we can eradicate racism and allyship, creating these bonds with people that can make a huge difference.
How do you see your purpose as an activist and also a citizen of your community?
My role, I believe, is just to be there for the people in my community, because I'm blessed to be from a place where I grew up here and played basketball here, and the support I got was unreal, and it's about time that I gave it back. And Austining can set the tone, and that's why I love being a part of this community, because we can set an example for what other communities should do.
Jalay is using her position in her community to promote equity, and she hopes that her efforts will inspire activism in other communities. I used my poem to try and express what happens to people in my community on a daily basis. We have spoken up. Now it's the responsibility of others to listen. You're listening to Sprouts from Pacifica, radio from the grassroots. Sprouts is a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. Today, we're talking about youth resisting racism. I'm Justin from Outcasting. You just heard my poem, Thoughts, and an interview with Jalay Knowles, founder of What About Us, a local activist organization in New York. This piece originally aired on Outcasting Overtime, produced by Mark Sofis. Next, we'll hear from Katie Stone and the crew of the Children's Hour. Joining them are behavioral psychologist Dr. Rebecca Ezechukwu and Dr. Danielle Riddle.
I'm delighted to be here with a lot of great people. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Well, let's see who's here.
Hi, it's Maya.
Hello, it's Zen.
Hello, it's Amadeus.
Hi, it's Isaac.
Hello, it's Octavia.
Hi, it's Lucas.
Hi, it's Evan.
Happy day, it's Maya.
Hi, it's Daniel.
Well, today on the show, we are going to be talking about a topic that can make people very uncomfortable to discuss: racism. But I'll tell you something. Racism actually can make other people who are the victims of it more than just uncomfortable. In fact, racism is deadly and it's toxic for our culture. But I'm curious, how would you guys define racism?
It's where somebody is judging you by the color of your skin, and it's a lie. They're lying to you, and people just believe that lie.
I think that racism is kind of a bias to a certain race or a certain type of people, which is not very good. You know, we all need to be working together and, you know, accept each other as we are, you know, and not necessarily be biased to one person, race, or something along those lines. But, you know, yeah, I guess that's kind of what it is, in a sense.
All of those seem really plausible. And we're going to talk more about racism and being anti-racist. With us today is Dr. Rebecca Ezechukwu. She is a clinical psychologist in the Division of Community Behavioral Health and an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of New Mexico Health Sciences Center. Also with us is Dr. Danielle Riddle Price. She is a clinical psychologist working in private practice with Riddle Price Associates. They provide mental health services to youth and their families. Welcome to the Children's Hour.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. We're glad to be here.
You heard the kids try to define what racism is. Can you tell us what do you think of their definitions? How did they do? And how would you define racism?
Well, I think the kids have a great start. And I heard some good comments about, you know, biases towards certain races, treating people differently because of the color of their skin. And I really think that we're getting close to what racism is, because I think it is one of those topics that sometimes can be really confusing and hard to understand. And Dr. Danielle and I were talking before this, and I thought that she had a really great way of simplifying this for kids maybe who are just now learning about what racism is or trying to understand it a little bit better. So Danielle, let me kick it to you.
Great definitions, very good definitions. And it's when I'm working with clients,
who are some of your ages, actually. And I work with them and I teach them about unfair. Who in the room has something that happened to them that was unfair? Can everyone say they've had something happen that they thought was unfair?
Yeah, for sure.
Yes. So I see somebody has a brother and sister. So is there ever some unfairness that you see between brothers and sisters?
Yeah.
And sometimes we feel like they get treated unfairly, like they get two scoops of ice cream instead of one, or they get to get a new bike, or they get new tennis shoes and you don't. So if you think about it in terms of what's fair and unfair, we understand that. We understand that it's not fair for you to get to go outside and play for an hour and I can't go outside at all. So if you look at it in the terms of, if it's unfair to treat someone a certain way because of the color of their skin, it's unfair for them to be hurt or to be scared or to be fearful or to not have the same breaks in life just because they happen to be a different shade, right? So that's how you look at it when you look at being fair and unfair. And that just makes it really simple. If you can be kind to everyone, no matter what they look like, that's a huge step, right? And getting rid of that bias. I think I love what Maya said. It's like they're lying to you about what they see when they see that person. And I think it's very helpful for us to keep in mind that we just want to be fair. We want to be treated fair. How would you want to be treated?
Kids don't start off being racist, do they?
No. If you think about it, the simplest way is preschool, you know, or little kids playing at the park when they're toddlers. They don't care what color the other kid they're playing with is. They just want to play because that's their friend, right? It's more of a small cues that are provided from their parents or people around them, because we are their filters. Parents are your filters to the world. So how they react to people around you is how you learn to react and how you view things and things that we say without even realizing it. There are some things that we say and don't do. And sometimes it's not, you're teaching your kid to be racist, but you're not teaching them to not be racist. If that makes sense.
Well, we definitely want to cover that on the Children's Hour. Not only how to understand what racism is, but also how to be anti-racist. Have any of you learned about racism in school?
Partly.
Yeah.
Not really.
I'm sure, yeah.
Really, like history. Like history,
yeah.
Like taking like the people of different color as slaves and... So yeah, we've learned about it in history, but not like modern racism.
Once I became a homeschool, then I started to learn about it a little bit more. But apart from that, no.
In school, no, but homeschooled, yes.
Why aren't we learning about racism in school? And what could schools be doing?
Well, I think that's a great question. And I'm amazed, but also not completely surprised to see all of the kids kind of shaking their heads about not learning so much about racism. You know, I will say at this point, I think children are never too young to talk about race and it's never too late to start. And so for the parents who are listening, I would encourage you to, you know, for young kids, you know, preschool and younger, some of what you're doing to start to help kids develop their anti-racist qualities and just being anti-racist. And so, you know, helping kids to just notice what they're seeing in the world, describing physical differences associated with race, you know, like skin tone, voices. I think, you know, as far as how we teach kids and how we learn, it's not just learning about racism, it's learning how to recognize and understand the privilege that being white, you know, being a white person has had a lot of privilege over history. And sometimes the ways that we see that privilege, we may not even realize. So if you think about it, the books that you read may have characters that are all white in skin tone. And so one way that we can start to even just introduce this understanding that there are multiple and varied individuals and races is just introducing folks to those materials at a very early age. So when you're in your classroom, even looking through your history books, what are the images that you're seeing? You know, that can tell you a lot about what has already existed before you.
I am watching Little House on the Prairie. It has racism in it. Because the mom, she never wants to see a black person, a Native American.
Mm-hmm. And do you know, can you tell how she's feeling when she says that she never wants to see a Native American?
She's feeling upset.
She's feeling upset. And I would bet she's probably also feeling scared. So one of the things that we know contributes to racism is when we feel scared scared of people because of their race. And for many of us, we may not realize that we're feeling scared. But oftentimes, if we pay attention to the way that our bodies feel, you know, when we're witnessing racism or we're witnessing really stressful experiences like protests, our bodies can tell us a lot about what we might be feeling. And so noticing, you know, is our heart beating fast when we're trying to have these conversations? Or are we feeling like it's very hard to talk when we notice somebody else experiencing racism? Or are we having trouble asking our parents questions? Sometimes that's a way that might contribute to not talking about these very important topics. It's really interesting. I think a lot of kids actually have a lot of questions about race that they don't feel comfortable asking their parents. And so again, if I were to give advice to the parents out there, it would be to, you know, ask your kids what they're seeing, you know, and sometimes just leading with open-ended questions. So what did you see today on the news? Or what did you see outside? And how are you feeling? What questions might you have? And I think parents sometimes get really worried about having all the right answers for these conversations. And sometimes if you're just creating the space for kids to express what they're seeing, that can actually open the conversation up quite a bit. And you may find as a parent, you actually do have the ability to navigate these conversations.
We have to talk about what's happening now on the ground in our country. And I want to ask the kids crew, have you been following the news? Does anyone want to sort of take a stab at what are you seeing in the news?
Okay, so I believe that after the murder of a black man, George Floyd, when a police officer knelt on his neck for about 8 minutes, suffocating him, there were many protests of police brutality and racism that police are going into using tear gas, rubber bullets, all these horrible things. And these are peaceful protesters, yet the police are still using mace and all this horrible stuff. And I believe the protest is in 400, 500 major cities now.
I heard this a while ago, but Donald Trump, he's going to be removing all black people and putting them in jail.
Oh, Maya, there is a lot of misinformation going around, and that one is definitely not true. I want to ask our doctors who are with us, our psychologists, Dr. Ezechukwu and Dr. Danielle, can we talk a little bit about what's happening right now? And, you know, clearly kids see it from all different kinds of ways.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Dr. Danielle and I have clinical practice, and so we have been having these conversations with the kids in our clinical practice. And depending on how old kids are, their ways of making sense of this information is going to be very different. Even, you know, the difference between what you're seeing and what you're hearing and, you know, equating that with truth. And so Lucas was the person who mentioned that most of these protests are peaceful. And that's right. And I think that's one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, the ability to protest is a constitutional liberty. It's a right. And the fact that people are out there using their voices to protest racism and police brutality and injustice is a right that they have. And so I think recognizing that the majority of people who are out there are doing this for purposes of making this country better, for using their voices, for demonstrating that what we've been experiencing as a country is not okay. And we don't want to continue to say that it's okay. Because there is violence also happening within these peaceful protests, that makes everything much more confusing and I think a lot scarier when you're a kid. And so what I would encourage, you know, the kids that are seeing some of what's happening in our community or watching it on the news is asking your parents questions about what you're seeing. And I think this is also where a conversation about healthy media intake comes into play and ensuring that parents are watching media with their kids. So if there are things that you are both watching together, at least parents can help correct any misconceptions or at the very least be a supportive presence for a child to just express what they're seeing. It's really important for us to ask kids what they're seeing and what questions they have, rather than assuming that we know how they're making sense of all this information. Because, you know, as Maya indicated, there's a lot of content too that they may just hear passing through a room.
A big question that's come up is a lot of my clients have asked me, what can they do to help their Black friends? And some of the Black kids have asked as well, how do we, all my friends are white, what do I do? You know, I don't want to feel bad against them, they're still my friends. So helping them understand, just to have the conversation, just saying I support you as my friend is all you have to do. You know, for the kids who have friends who are African American, being there, not shunning the conversation away if it comes up, and just saying I support you. They've gotten a lot of phone calls from friends, or they've called their friends saying, I support you and I'm sorry this is happening to people that you may know or people that look like you. So for all the parents, limit the amount of exposure that you're giving from COVID-19 to the racism acts that are happening, making sure that you're running that boat with your kids, and that you're that voice that tells them how to handle their anger and what to do.
So what can we do to be anti-racist?
I think first being aware that people are different than you, being aware that just because you're not afraid to be on your bike driving down the street, or if you get pulled over, you're not afraid that the police are going to harm you, or that someone's going to do something to you. Being aware that if you have a Black friend, that they do have that fear, that they may have that fear. So just being understanding of that. I think learning to understand other races, so doing some reading on your own. You have your phones and your computers and your tablets, so you can research a lot of things that are age appropriate for you. And if you need help, you can always go to your parents, go to a teacher. One of the kids decided to do a book report, one of my clients, on an African American from back in the Civil War times, just because he wanted to learn. So he had to do his own research. So when you have a choice at school to pick someone, when they give you assignments for history, you can pick someone who's African American, or just listening to what you're thinking when you see someone of a different color or race. You know, how are you feeling when you see them? Are you afraid? Are you nervous? Are you anxious? Are you happy? Do you see them as different? And then asking a parent or someone, say, why do I feel that way about them? What is it about them that's making me feel differently than I would if they were white?
Yeah, I think those were great, Dr. Danielle. I would just add that I think for the kids that identify as white on the crew, and just who, you know, those that are listening, I think it's really important to ask your parents and learn about your own racial and cultural identity. And I think that, you know, oftentimes when we're talking about race, we sort of just assume that race is only impacting people of color. But white is a race as well. And sometimes when we're able to learn more about our own backgrounds, it actually makes it easier to learn about other people and understand and accept the differences that other people have that make them unique. I think also, you know, as a kid, ways to be anti-racist, to be, you know, white allies or accomplice is another term that I've heard lately as well. But it's understanding that people get bullied for lots of different reasons, including their skin color. And so if you see something like that happening, letting people know you're bullying, that's racist, I don't accept that. And just being able to stand up to that as you can. So think about how you might feel when you see something like that happen. Angry, confused, shocked, sad. The ability to be able to name what you're feeling is going to help you. And I think asking a teacher, a parent, a coach, anybody that you trust, and just letting them know that you saw that, and know that it takes a lot of courage to tell someone when you see something like that happening. And just to recognize, like, it takes bravery, and we can do it. It's one way to support others.
Dr. Rebecca Esichukwu, clinical psychologist in the Division of Community and Behavioral Health and an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of New Mexico Health Sciences Center. And Dr. Danielle Riddle Price is a clinical psychologist working in private practice. Her practice is named Riddle Price Associates, and they provide mental health services to youth and their families. She's also a member of the Black Mental Health Coalition. It's just been such a pleasure to have you on the Children's Hour. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about this today.
I was so excited to meet all of you. And thank you for all of your questions and for the work that you're doing. Remember that you are the role models for your peers and your friends. And so I ask that you continue to probe and ask those questions, like Dr. Rebecca said, and to notice when there's inequality, notice when things are unfair, and how you feel about it and what you can do.
You know, I have just loved being a part of this conversation and hearing these real kid questions, because I think many kids may be more equipped to start these conversations than parents. And parents, be brave. So thank you for having me today.
That does it for this week's edition of Sprouts, featuring content from Outcasting Media, creator of Public Radio's LGBTQ youth programs, online at outcastingmedia.org, and the Children's Hour, making radio for kids with kids, online at childrenshour.org. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. This edition was co-produced by Stephanie Schubert of Pacifica, Mark Sofis of Outcasting Media, and Katie Stone of The Children's Hour. Sprouts is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio, thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your radio station has a production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Dustin in New York. Thank you for listening. See you next time on Sprouts.
Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.